We would like to send out a special thanks to Shudder for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Shudder is a premium streaming video service from AMC Networks, featuring a great collection of thrillers, horror, and suspense. Try Shudder free for 30 days by visiting shudder.com/podcast and using the promo code COLD. That's shudder.com/podcast and the promo code is COLD. Enjoy the show. October 24th, 1953. La Crosse, Wisconsin. The father of 15-year-old Evelyn Hartley attempts to phone her while she is babysitting an infant child, but receives no answer. After traveling to the house, he discovers that Evelyn has disappeared, and the evidence suggests she was the victim of a violent abduction by an intruder. Days later, blood-stained clothing, including women's undergarments, a denim jacket, and a pair of tennis shoes, are discovered miles away and believed to be connected to the case. Over the years, there would be a number of potential suspects and the discovery of a tape-recorded confession to the crime, but Evelyn Hartley is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today I'll be covering a frightening missing persons case which took place 65 years ago, the 1953 disappearance of Evelyn Hartley. As you probably know, our show is going to be spending the month of October covering mysteries which either took place on Halloween or have some sort of Halloween slant to them. While this particular case took place on October 24th, 1 week before Halloween, it fits this month's criteria because the story resembles something you would expect to find in a horror movie. One of the most popular horror films of all time is John Carpenter's 1978 classic Halloween, which came out 40 years ago this month, and at the time of this episode's release, a new sequel is set to come out in theaters in 2 days. As you probably know, the storyline involves Jamie Lee Curtis's character being stalked by the mass slasher Michael Myers while she is babysitting on Halloween night. The idea of a teenage girl being terrorized while babysitting is a popular trope in horror stories, but today's episode is a real-life version of this, as a 15-year-old girl named Evelyn Hartley was violently abducted from the home of a family friend while looking after their infant daughter. There would be a number of interesting developments in this case, including the suspected involvement of one of the most infamous murderers of all time, Ed Gein, but throughout it all, Evelyn is still a missing person. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. And we've also recently been added to Spotify as well. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the terrifying disappearance of Evelyn Hartley. Our story begins in La Crosse, Wisconsin in 1953. Our central figure is 15-year-old Evelyn Hartley, who lives with her parents, Richard and Ethel Hartley. Evelyn is one of four children, though she lost her brother to polio years earlier. The Hartleys moved to La Crosse from Charleston, Illinois in 1950, and Richard now works as a biology professor at La Crosse State College. Evelyn is a junior at Central High School, and is considered to be an excellent honor student with a straight A average. On the evening of Saturday, October 24th, Evelyn was picked up at her home by Viggo Rasmussen, a co-worker of her father's who worked as a physics professor at La Crosse State College. Viggo, his wife, and 7-year-old daughter were all planning to attend the college's homecoming football game that evening, which was always a huge deal in the town, and needed a babysitter to watch over their 20-month-old infant daughter, Janice. They had a regular babysitter named Janice Cowley, but she would also be attending the game that night, so the Rasmussens asked Evelyn if she would take the job instead. Evelyn agreed, and this would be her first babysitting job in 3 months. After being picked up by Viggo at 6:30 p.m., Evelyn was taken to the Rasmussen home. The house was located in a new subdivision on Heschler Drive, and the Rasmussens had only lived there for 3 months. Evelyn lived only about 5 minutes away, and told her parents she would phone them at 8:30 p.m. to check in. She was told to put baby Janice to bed at 7 o'clock, and since she was going to be sleeping most of the evening, Evelyn brought several schoolbooks along with her to spend the time studying. The Rasmussens then left to attend the game, while Evelyn remained alone with her daughter. However, 8:30 came and went, and the Hartleys did not receive their scheduled phone call from Evelyn. Richard Hartley tried calling the Rasmussen home multiple times, but received no answer, and he even tried calling neighbors of the Rasmussens to check if they had seen her. After not hearing from Evelyn, Richard decided to go check on his daughter. He arrived at the Rasmussen residence at around 9:20 and discovered the front door was locked. The lights inside the house were still on, but even after Richard repeatedly knocked, rang the doorbell, and shouted for Evelyn, no one answered. Since the living room window had no curtains, Richard decided to peek inside and was very concerned when he noticed that Evelyn's school books were scattered around the floor, along with one of her shoes and her eyeglasses, which were now broken. Richard desperately tried to enter the house, but found that most of the doors and windows were locked. However, when he went around back, he discovered the basement window was open, and that the screen had been removed, and was now leaning up against the outside wall. Richard decided to enter the dark basement through the window, and turned on the lights. A stepladder, which the Rasmussens had been using to paint the basement, was next to the window, and Richard noticed that Evelyn's second shoe was at the bottom of the stairs. He went upstairs into the living room, and noticed that the radio was still playing. In addition to Evelyn's items being scattered across the floor, the furniture had been disarranged, so all indications were that a violent struggle had taken place. Thankfully, baby Janice was discovered to be sleeping unharmed inside her crib. The child was uncovered, even though the Rasmussens had given Evelyn instructions to cover Janice with her blanket at 7:15 p.m., so this seemed to indicate that Evelyn went missing shortly after she put the child to bed at 7 o'clock. Richard quickly went to a neighbor and asked him to phone the police. When they arrived, they found more evidence that an intruder had entered the house and abducted Evelyn. Other windows were discovered to have pry marks from a screwdriver on them, so the intruder had likely tried to break in elsewhere before entering through the basement. A set of footprints made by a pair of sneakers were found in a flower bed near the basement window, and there was also dirty footprints on the living room rug. But most disturbingly, there were 2 pools of blood found outside the house. One of them was located in the Rasmussen's yard near the basement window, while the other was about 100 feet away next to a neighbor's garage. If that wasn't enough, a bloody palm print was also on the garage's wall, and additional bloodstains were discovered on the side of another neighbor's house. Testing would eventually show that all this blood was type A, which matched Evelyn's blood type. Red cloth fibers were also found in some of the blood, and Evelyn was wearing red pants at the time she disappeared. It was theorized that while being dragged through the yard by her abductor, Evelyn had either rested or fallen on the ground to create the pools of blood. Tracking dogs would follow Evelyn's scent through the backyard and past some neighbors' homes to an adjacent street called Cooley Drive. The scent trail then abruptly came to an end, suggesting that Evelyn may have been placed in a vehicle and driven away. It wasn't long before a number of eyewitnesses would report strange occurrences in the neighborhood that night. Neighbors would recall hearing screams sometime between 7 o'clock and 7:15 p.m., but assumed it was nothing more than children playing. Given the time frame, it seemed likely that the screams were connected to Evelyn's disappearance. Another witness also remembered seeing a light-colored tan sedan circling the neighborhood at least 3 times at around 8 p.m. But the most interesting eyewitness account came from a man named Ed Hofer. In order to protect his identity, the original newspaper articles about the case simply referred to him as Mr. X. At around 7:15 p.m., Hofer was picking up his brother-in-law at his house, which was located 1 block from the Rasmussen residence, when he claimed he saw 2 men and a girl staggering down the street in the distance, next to the same house where bloodstains were later found. It was too dark to get a good look at them, and Hofer just assumed it was people who had been drinking to celebrate the homecoming game. A few minutes later, Hofer and his brother-in-law were driving away when they almost ran into a two-tone green 1942 Buick, which was speeding westward. The car was being driven by a man, and Hofer also saw a second man sitting in the back seat alongside a girl who had her head slumped forward. After learning about Evelyn's abduction, these incidents suddenly took on more significance for Hofer, and he contacted the police. As far as anyone could tell, nothing appeared to have been stolen from the Rasmussen home, which seemed to go against the idea that she was abducted during an attempted burglary. Needless to say, Evelyn's disappearance would launch one of the largest missing persons investigations in the history of Wisconsin, as over 2,000 people volunteered to participate in the search for her. Her disappearance terrified the community so much that a 10 p.m. curfew was implemented for teenagers. Investigators launched a unique vehicle inspection program in order to search every vehicle in the county. If a car was inspected and ruled out as having any connection to Evelyn's abduction, it would be given a sticker which read, "My car is okay." Gas station attendants were also told to be on the lookout for any cars which had bloodstains and report them. Recently dug graves were also checked to see if perhaps someone had placed Evelyn's body inside there. In the year following Evelyn's disappearance, investigators would question over 3,500 potential suspects, but failed to turn up any promising leads. One of the most unusual aspects of the investigation occurred in May of 1954, when the biggest mass lie detector test in the history of criminal investigation took place. It was decided that all of the male students and faculty of each high school in the area, approximately 1,750 people in total, would be questioned about Evelyn's disappearance while taking a polygraph. About 300 people were tested before the school board intervened and forced law enforcement to bring the whole thing to a halt. Anyway, on October 27th, 3 days after Evelyn went missing, a pair of women's underpants and a brassiere, both stained with blood, were found 2 miles south of La Crosse near the underpass of Highway 14. Interestingly enough, this particular area had been searched 1 day beforehand, but the undergarments were not there, leading to speculation that someone had driven through the area and tossed them outside a moving vehicle. The undergarments appeared to be Evelyn's size, and the blood was type A. A blood-stained pair of men's pants were also found 4 miles away along the same road, though it can never be established if they were connected to the case. On Halloween, a pair of size 11 Goodrich tennis shoes were discovered alongside Highway 14 near the village of Coon Valley, 14 miles southeast of La Crosse. About 300 feet away from the shoes was a size 36 blue denim jacket, and both items had type A bloodstains on them. Investigators felt there was a good chance the tennis shoes belonged to Evelyn's abductor, as their soles seemed to match the footprints found at the Rasmussen home. This prompted investigators to check with Goodrich to learn everything they could about this particular brand of shoes. The brand was called Hood Mogul, and sold in Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois, though they had not been sold in Wisconsin for at least 3 years. The shoes had a distinctive circular wear pattern on the soles, which suggested that their owner may have frequently rode a Whizzer motorbike. There was also a hair found inside one of the shoes, which may have belonged to an African-American male, though I'm not sure if they were able to conclusively establish that. It was also believed that the denim jacket belonged to the person who kidnapped Evelyn, as there were blood smears found at the Rasmussen residence, which seemed to have been made with cloth with the characteristics of denim. The jacket contained faded spots underneath both armpits, which appeared to have been caused by a safety harness commonly worn by people who worked as steeplejacks, which involved scaling high structures such as steeples and chimneys to repair them. Investigators were able to track down a local man who had manufactured safety harnesses for two steeplejacks the previous year, but all he remembered about them is that they were young and possibly from the area. It was believed that the jacket was too small to have been worn by someone who wore size 11 shoes, but this also lent credence to the idea that two perpetrators may have been involved in Evelyn's abduction. Investigators would bring the shoes and jacket to 31 different communities and put them on display for thousands of people, but no one recognized them, and it never led to any leads. Well, within a few years, a very infamous suspect would pop up on the radar. You're probably familiar with the name Ed Gein. During the intro, I mentioned how the story seemed like something you would find in a horror film, but Ed Gein is responsible for inspiring some of the most famous horror movie villains of all time, including Norman Bates from Psycho, Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. Gein lived on a farm near the small town of Plainfield, Wisconsin, and earned the nickname The Butcher of Plainfield, but even though he is often referred to as a serial killer, he technically only has two confirmed victims, a tavern owner named Mary Hogan, and a hardware store employee named Bernice Worden. The main reason Gein attained so much notoriety is because he liked to dig up bodies from the cemetery, take them to his farmhouse, and fashion items from their bones and skin. Gein was arrested on November 16, 1957, the same day he murdered Bernice Worden, as her mutilated body and the remains of several deceased individuals he had dug up were found at his home. He wound up pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, and after he was deemed mentally incompetent to stand trial, Gein was sent to the Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, and he remained incarcerated in mental health facilities until his death in 1984. Well, it turned out that Gein was originally born in La Crosse before his family moved to Plainfield during his childhood. Now, many accounts of this case state that Gein was visiting relatives in La Crosse on the night Evelyn was abducted, and that they lived only a few blocks away from the Rasmussen residence. This would definitely make him a tempting suspect, but I'm not entirely sure how accurate this information is. During a lot of the original newspaper articles about the case, it states that when Gein was questioned about Evelyn's disappearance, he claimed that he never returned to La Crosse since his family moved away from there when he was 7 years old, and that he would have been working on a neighbor's farm near Plainfield at the time Evelyn went missing. None of the remains found on Gein's farm belonged to Evelyn, and there was no evidence linking him to her abduction. After Gein passed two lie detector tests, investigators ruled him out as a suspect. Anyway, several decades passed, and there would be very little movement in Evelyn's case. In 1989, a documentary was produced about her disappearance by La Crosse's local television station, WKBT-TV. It was titled The Evelyn Hartley Story, and you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. Shortly after it aired, the reporter who hosted the documentary, Steve Botham, was contacted by two anonymous witnesses who had watched it and thought they recognized the blood-stained denim jacket and tennis shoes which were found. The witnesses believed it belonged to a local farmer, and apparently, on the day of Evelyn's disappearance, he had been working in the fields and talking about going into town to find a woman. At the time, the farmer was wearing a denim jacket and tennis shoes, which he often wore, and driving a dark-colored 1938 Chevrolet. He became agitated when the work went on longer than expected, but finally left at around 6:30 p.m. But after this, the witnesses claim they never saw him wear the jacket or the tennis shoes or drive the Chevrolet again. By the time they came forward with this story, the farmer had been dead for over 10 years. Steve Botham did make an attempt to track down the blood-stained denim jacket and tennis shoes, but none of the various crime labs could find the items, so it appeared that the evidence had been lost. The investigation came to a dead halt once again, but another interesting development took place shortly after a 50th anniversary article about Evelyn's disappearance was published in October of 2003. This jogged the memory of a man named Mel Williams, who remembered a tape recording he had made decades earlier. Once Williams discovered he still had the tape, he turned it over to the police and shared a strange story. In 1968, Williams went to a tavern in the small town of Lafarge and brought a reel-to-reel tape recorder to record the band who was playing there that night. he decided to record a conversation with a local character who frequented the tavern, named Clyde Tywee Peterson, and it wasn't long before they were joined by another man named Whitey Barclay, who suddenly said, "Tell them about that Hartley girl you kidnapped, Tywee." Incredibly, Peterson proceeded to share a story about he traveled to La Crosse with an accomplice and a mutual friend of theirs, where they proceeded to abduct Evelyn Hartley. Now, the original article about this story from the Mattoon Journal Gazette says that the accomplice's name is Jack Golfair with a P, but I think that was a misprint, and that his actual last name was Golfair with a T. I'll go into this in more detail in a little while. Anyway, Evelyn's abduction was apparently Golfair's idea, and he knew she was babysitting at the Rasmussens that night. The group took Evelyn to the mutual friend's farm, where Golfair killed her before they buried her body somewhere. The conversation eventually reached the point where Peterson told Williams to stop the tape. Williams claimed he couldn't remember exactly what happened next, but he wound up taking the tape home and completely forgot about it until his wife read the 50th anniversary article and reminded him about it. Anyway, at the time the recording was made, Jack Golfair was already dead after having committed suicide. By the time Williams came forward, Peterson and the other unnamed accomplice were also deceased, and Whitey Barclay was in his 90s and suffering from dementia, so he could not answer any questions before his death in 2007. The police said they would look into these allegations, possibly by exhuming the bodies of the suspects and matching their DNA to the blood evidence found at the scene, but as far as I can tell, it doesn't look like this was ever done. While Peterson did reveal Evelyn's alleged burial location during the recording, this information has been withheld from the public. It was revealed that the location was in a Mississippi River floodplain, so unfortunately, Evelyn's remains likely washed away years ago. In spite of these new revelations, the investigation seems to have come to a standstill once again. Evelyn's disappearance had a profound effect on both the Hartley and Rasmussen families. In 1971, after Richard Hartley retired from La Crosse State College, the family moved to Oregon. Both of Evelyn's parents and her older brother Thomas have since passed away, but her younger sister Carol is still alive. In February of 1997, Janice Rasmussen, who was present and sleeping during Evelyn's abduction when she was 20 months old, agreed to give an interview for the La Crosse Tribune. By this point, Janice was 45 years old and said that the incident made her parents become extra protective of her and her sister. The Rasmussens immediately sold their house and moved to a new home, where bars were installed on the basement window. In 2017, the Rasmussens' eldest daughter, Rosalind, who attended the homecoming game with her parents that night, also did an interview for the La Crosse Tribune, and she concurred that the case made her father extra paranoid about his children's safety, and that he was never quite the same. After 65 years, Evelyn Hartley's remains have never been found, and the identity of her abductor, or abductors, continues to remain unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out another huge thanks to Shudder for supporting our podcast. Shudder is a premium streaming video service from AMC Networks featuring a great collection of thrillers, horror, and suspense. It should probably come as no surprise to you that all of us here at The Trail Went Cold are major horror movie fans, and since we've been spending October working on and releasing Halloween-themed episodes, what better way to spend our free time this month than by utilizing this amazing resource where there is just so much great horror content to choose from? Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated section of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. They provide unlimited, ad-free access on all your favorite devices, such as Android, Apple TV, and iPhone, for only $4.99 per month, or $49.99 per year. Shudder has a unique library of exclusive and original films and series, horror classics, and blockbuster hits, which are updated every week to keep the selection fresh. Current Shudder exclusives include last year's Cuso by Flying Lotus, Mayhem by Joe Lynch, or Sequence Break by Graham Skipper. Quite frankly, there is just such a great selection of titles that I almost wanted to take a brief vacation from the podcast and just spend the entire month of October going through their catalog. Of course, Shudder is currently streaming some of my favorite horror classics, such as Night of the Living Dead, Reanimator, Evil Dead 2, and Black Christmas, but it's also a great resource for introducing me to titles I wasn't familiar with, particularly with their Shudder exclusives. One terrific film from France I just discovered is Revenge, which is labeled as the boldest, bloodiest movie of the year, and certainly lives up to the hype. It's a crazy revenge thriller about a young woman who was assaulted and left for dead in the desert, but decides to go after the perpetrators and seek retribution in the most bloody, violent fashion imaginable. It's extremely well made, and very empowering as well, and I might not have ever found out about it if it wasn't offered as a Shudder exclusive. So if you're a horror fan, I give Shudder the highest possible recommendation, and in order to try it free for 30 days, please visit shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code COLD. That's shudder.com/podcast and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the rest of the episode. Whenever a horrific crime like this takes place, you'll often hear comments about how things were never the same in the community again, and that definitely rings true here. La Crosse, Wisconsin wasn't an overly small town, as it had a population of around 47,000 in 1953, but they had never seen anything like this before. The idea of a teenage girl being abducted from a home while she was babysitting was absolutely terrifying, and since Evelyn was never found, and the perpetrator was never identified, La Crosse lived in fear for a long time. There were stories about how men would stay home from work because they didn't want to leave their wives and children alone, and nobody, especially teenage girls, wanted to babysit after this. The situation was especially heartbreaking for Evelyn's parents, as Evelyn apparently wanted to back out of the babysitting job, but her mother, Ethel, told her that she had to do it because she made a commitment. In cases where children are murdered or go missing, you'll sometimes hear the parents say they were hit with an unexplained gut feeling that something was wrong right before it happened. At around 7 p.m, shortly after Evelyn left to go babysitting, Ethel had one of those gut feelings and wanted to call the Rasmussen home, but her husband convinced her it wasn't necessary since Evelyn was planning to call at 8:30. And of course, 7 p.m. is the approximate time period when Evelyn was believed to have been abducted. When the Hartleys arrived at the Rasmussen home and saw the pools of blood outside, Ethel completely broke down and said she knew at that moment that her daughter was dead. And of course, even though their baby daughter was left unharmed, this incident had a profound effect on the Rasmussen family since the crime took place at their house. There was no way they could possibly live there anymore after what happened, and it sounds like Viggo Rasmussen was overly paranoid and protective of his daughters for the rest of his life. It's bad enough that Evelyn vanished while babysitting, but the fact that there was blood evidence, her glasses were broken, and her shoes were left behind clearly indicated that she was the victim of a violent crime, and the odds of her surviving it were not good. It's quite fascinating to look back and see how this investigation was handled, as there are so many things which took place that you would never see today. This is the only case I've ever heard of where vehicles in the community were inspected and had a sticker attached to them which read, "My car is okay." And can you imagine what the reaction would be in this day and age if law enforcement announced they were going to visit all the schools in the community and give polygraph tests to all the male students? Parents would absolutely blow a gasket. Of course, back then, people were not as aware of just how unreliable polygraph tests are, and these days, you'll often hear attorneys advise people not to take them at all, even if they're completely innocent. But it was just a much different time back then, as Evelyn's father, Richard Hartley, immediately volunteered to take a polygraph just so he could officially be cleared as a suspect, though no one really believed he was responsible. Even though the school board eventually put a stop to the polygraphs, it sounds like the 300 or so people who took them were very cooperative and none of them objected. On the surface, this might seem like a fairly straightforward case. We know Evelyn was abducted and likely murdered, but the one thing we don't know is who the perpetrator was. However, there are still a number of baffling unanswered questions about how these events might have unfolded. Since Evelyn was abducted while babysitting at another family's house, this opened up debate about whether she was specifically targeted or if she was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. This episode is reminiscent of a case I featured on the podcast last year, the 1984 disappearance of 12-year-old Janelle Matthews. While she was alone at night, someone snatched Janelle from her home, and some of her clothing, including her shoes, was left behind. Since her family was away, the big unanswered question has always been if Janelle was targeted because someone knew she was going to be home alone on a weeknight, or if her abduction was just completely random. Of course, the key difference between Janelle's case and Evelyn Hartley's disappearance is that Evelyn was babysitting at another family's house, so you have to wonder how many people knew she was going to be there. There's been discussion over the fact that Evelyn had never babysat for the Rasmussens before, and only took the job because the regular babysitter, Janice Cowley, was attending the homecoming game that night. Since the homecoming game was such a big deal in lacrosse, and Viggo Rasmussen was a professor at the college, someone who knew the Rasmussen family's routine might have assumed he would be attending the game and hire his regular babysitter to watch his infant daughter that night, but didn't plan on Evelyn being there instead. While no one has ever turned up any evidence to suggest that Janice Cowley was the intended target, it would be one thing if this had been a last-minute arrangement, but Evelyn had agreed to babysit at the Rasmussen residence days in advance. Throughout the investigation, no one uncovered anybody in Evelyn's background who seemed like a potential suspect with a motive to murder her. The one aspect of this case which does seem pretty clear is the approximate time period when Evelyn was abducted. She had instructions to put baby Janice to bed at 7 p.m. and cover her with her blanket at 7:15, but since the child was found uncovered, Evelyn was presumably taken before she could do this. Given that the neighbors recalled hearing screams during this 15-minute window, you can definitely pinpoint it as the time when Evelyn was being attacked. Now, even if Evelyn herself was not specifically targeted, one aspect of this case which is still up for debate is whether the person who took her was an opportunistic predator, or if they were attempting a burglary and did not know that anyone was in the house. As hard as it may be to fathom now, there were no curtains on the living room window of the Rasmussen residence. This is just another symptom of it being a much different time period, as people felt safe living in this particular section of town. Someone cruising through the neighborhood could have caught a glimpse of the Rasmussen residence, seen a teenage girl sitting in the living room alone through the front window, and decided to take the opportunity to grab her. Pry marks were found on at least one other window, so it looked like the perpetrator made failed attempts to enter the house before they managed to get inside through the basement. So what if the perpetrator was a burglar? Yes, it appears that nothing was stolen from the house, but it's possible the burglar was forced to flee the scene without taking anything once they realized Evelyn was there. If she had seen his face or something, he might have felt he needed to abduct her from the scene. Like I mentioned earlier, given that Viggo Rasmussen was a professor at La Crosse State College, someone could have known he'd be attending the homecoming game that night with his family. They might have been under the mistaken impression that the house would be unoccupied, and unaware that there was a babysitter looking after their infant child. The problem with that theory is that anyone who went through the neighborhood on Heschler Drive that night would have been able to see that someone was inside the house through the front window since the living room lights were on. But on the other hand, the tracking dogs did follow Evelyn's scent through the backyard to Cooley Drive, where it's believed that her abductor placed her inside a vehicle and drove away. That particular spot is located northeast from the Rasmussen residence. If the perpetrator parked their vehicle on Cooley Drive and approached the house from the back, they might not have even seen the living room window and noticed the lights were on and someone was home. While it seems pretty clear how the abductor got inside the house, what's not so clear is how they got Evelyn out. Since Evelyn's school books were scattered throughout the living room, and her broken glasses and one of her shoes were on the floor, a struggle definitely took place there. And since Evelyn's other shoe was found in the basement, it's reasonable to assume that the perpetrator took her down there and dragged her out through the window, a point which is supported by the amount of blood which was found in the backyard and on the neighboring homes. However, it does seem like it would be difficult to exit through a basement window with a kidnapped girl in tow. We know that the front door and all the other entrances to the house were locked, since the only way Richard Hartley could get inside when he arrived was through the open basement window. Some newspaper accounts have stated that the front door of the Rasmussen residence was a self-locking door, which likely means you wouldn't have to use a key, and that it would lock automatically whenever you stepped outside and closed it. If that's the case, then theoretically, the abductor could have taken Evelyn out the front door and locked it behind them without using a key. But looking at the evidence, it would make sense for the perpetrator to take Evelyn outside through the basement window, as taking her out through the front door might attract too much attention. If the dogs' scent trail was accurate, and the getaway car was parked on Cooley Drive, northeast from the Rasmussen residence, then it would be quicker to escape out the back and cut through the backyard past the neighbors' houses toward the street. If they took Evelyn out the front door, then they'd have to travel north on Heschler Drive and turn right on Cooley Drive to walk towards the car, which is a longer route and runs a bigger risk of being spotted by neighbors. While there was a lot of blood found in the backyard and on the surrounding houses, no blood was found inside the Rasmussen residence, so it appears that Evelyn may have been violently attacked after she went outside. One theory I've seen proposed is that the screen to the basement window, which was found resting up against the house, might have been used as a weapon to strike Evelyn if she put up a struggle and tried to run away. This probably would have occurred at the spot next to the house where the pool of blood was found. Since a second pool of blood was found next to a neighbor's garage, Evelyn likely fell down or was forced down there while she was being dragged towards Cooley Drive. Of course, it's been theorized that at least two perpetrators may have been responsible for Evelyn's abduction, and there seems to be evidence both for and against this theory. On one hand, there was only one set of male footprints found both inside and outside the house. But on the other hand, there's the eyewitness account of Ed Hofer, who claims he saw two men and a girl staggering down Cooley Drive that night, around the approximate time period Evelyn is believed to have been abducted. He was also nearly hit by a speeding car, which likely contained these same three people, which seemed to indicate that they were trying to leave the area in a hurry. While Hofer didn't get a good enough look at the girl to positively identify her as Evelyn, the timing and circumstances of the whole thing lends credence to the idea that he unknowingly did see Evelyn while she was in the process of being abducted by two perpetrators. While there doesn't seem to be any physical evidence placing more than one intruder at the Rasmussen home, it's possible that only one of them actually went inside, while the other remained outside in the backyard as a lookout. This might explain how Evelyn was forcibly removed from the home through the basement window, as the second abductor may have been waiting there to help his partner drag her outside. It sounds like the dirty footprints found in the living room were the result of the intruder stepping in an outside flower bed, but if his accomplice never stepped in the dirt, then that would explain why he never left any footprints behind. Anyway, the other clues in this case were the blood-stained undergarments and brassiere found outside of town, which were believed to belong to Evelyn, along with a pair of pants, a denim jacket, and a pair of tennis shoes, which were all stained with blood. It was never conclusively established if the pants were connected to the case, but it seems very likely that the shoes and jacket were worn by the perpetrator since they matched physical evidence found at the scene. At the time, it was believed that the jacket was too small to be worn by someone who wore size 11 shoes. While this discrepancy could be explained away if two perpetrators were involved in the crime, as one of them could have been wearing the jacket while the other wore the shoes. It's actually quite fascinating to go back and read about the forensic testing and analysis which was performed on these items of clothing in 1953, as we were still many decades away from DNA profiling. So they had to look at the physical evidence and make educated guesses, such as that the perpetrator was a steeplejack or drove a Whizzer motorcycle. I don't know if these hunches were correct, since they never turned up any promising leads. They also seem to think that a hair found in one of the shoes belonged to an African-American male, but I don't know if they were able to conclusively prove that. If this crime had taken place today, and investigators found bloody clothing which belonged to both the victim and the perpetrator, they might have been able to solve this case relatively quickly. It's frustrating to hear that the jacket and shoes were apparently lost by police over the years because if DNA testing was performed on the evidence, perhaps they might have turned up something. A lot of suspects have popped up on the radar these past several decades, but most of them have been ruled out, and there really isn't strong evidence pointing to anyone in particular. Let's start with Ed Gein, as he's one of the most notorious murderers of all time, and the one suspect who was most associated with this case. but quite frankly, I think his significance here is way overstated, as he was cleared as a suspect almost immediately. Yes, it seems they came to that conclusion because Geen passed two lie detector tests, and of course, these tests do not have the same weight today as they did in 1957. However, other than the fact that Geen was originally born in La Crosse, what connection does he have to Evelyn's case at all? I know that many accounts state that Geen was visiting relatives in La Crosse at the time Evelyn went missing, but I have my doubts that this is accurate. Like I mentioned earlier, a lot of the original newspaper accounts state that when Geen was questioned, he claimed that he had not been to La Crosse since he was 7 years old. While Geen did still have relatives living in La Crosse in 1953, I haven't seen any confirmation that he went to visit them at the time. But even if he did, Evelyn's abduction just does not fit Geen's MO at all. His two known murder victims, Mary Hogan and Bernice Worden, were women in their 50s who lived in the Plainfield area and he was personally acquainted with. It's believed that Geen killed them because they reminded him of his deceased mother, whom he had an obsession with. Performing a home invasion in another town over 100 miles away in order to abduct a random teenage girl does not sound like something Geen would do. And if the sighting from Ed Hofer was accurate, and two men abducted Evelyn, it seems really out of character for a loner like Geen to be working with an accomplice. It was also established that none of the human remains found on Geen's farm belonged to Evelyn. Yes, theoretically he could have disposed of her body somewhere else between La Crosse and Plainfield, but think about it. Would a guy who performs grave robbing and decorates his house with human remains really go to the trouble of disposing of a victim's body? Since Geen was arrested only 4 years after Evelyn went missing, I can see how it would be tempting to think there's a connection, but I really don't think he was responsible. Anyway, another potential suspect was the local farmer who was named when two anonymous witnesses came forward after the airing of the Evelyn Hartley Story documentary in 1989. As you recall, this farmer often liked to wear a blue denim jacket and tennis shoes and drove a dark-colored Chevrolet, but after he went into La Crosse on the evening of October 24, 1953, they never saw him wear those items or drive that car again. Of course, the obvious question is, why did it take these witnesses so long to come forward? Well, they claim that they did go to the La Crosse County District Attorney's Office with this information in 1973, but the office was not interested in pursuing it. The way the farmer allegedly said he was going to town to, quote-unquote, find a woman, lends credence to the idea that he may have been an opportunistic predator who happened to pass by the window of the Rasmussen residence and noticed that Evelyn was home alone. The part of this story which doesn't match up is him driving a Chevrolet, as the vehicle Ed Hofer saw in the neighborhood that night with the two men and the girl was described as a green Buick. Anyway, after these witnesses came forward, Steve Botham filmed a follow-up news segment containing this new information, and you can find it on YouTube alongside the Evelyn Hartley Story documentary. But this is the only source I could find out there which mentions the lead involving the farmer. Given that the suspect had been dead for 10 years by that point, I can only assume this never went anywhere. So that brings us to our most intriguing lead, the tape recording of an alleged confession to Evelyn's murder, which surfaced in 2003. It featured a conversation in which a man named Clyde Tywee Peterson claimed that himself, an accomplice named Jack Gaulther, and a mutual friend of theirs abducted Evelyn and took her to the mutual friend's farm, where Gaulther proceeded to murder and bury her body. Now this is another example of a witness not coming forward with key information about an unsolved cold case for decades. It's very strange how this guy, Mel Williams, just forgot about the recording and put it away somewhere, even though it practically contained a confession to the murder of a teenage girl. And since he had it on tape, it's not like Williams would have to worry about the police not believing his story. But since Peterson and the other man in the conversation, Whitey Barclay, sounded like they might be rough characters, perhaps Williams might have feared repercussions if he went to the authorities. Regardless, things might have turned out much differently in this case if they had been able to question Peterson while he was still alive. I know that criminals often get caught because they can't keep their mouths shut and brag about their crimes, but if Peterson was telling the truth, it's crazy that he would confess to such a heinous crime when he knew he was being recorded and not force Williams to turn over the tape after he turned it off. Whitey Barclay, the man who initiated this conversation to begin with, was described as being a quote-unquote big mouth, though it doesn't sound like he participated in Evelyn's abduction. I guess the big wild card in this equation is the mutual friend of Peterson and Jack Gaultier, as he's never been publicly named, and it was his farm where Evelyn was allegedly taken to and murdered. If there were three people involved in Evelyn's abduction, then this complicates things, since Ed Hofer only witnessed two men dragging a girl down the street and driving away from the scene that night. And there's also the fact that Gaultier was apparently the mastermind behind the whole thing, as he knew who Evelyn was, and that she would be babysitting at the Rasmussen residence that night. Well, the tavern where this recording took place was in the town of Lafarge, which is an hour away from La Crosse, though it's worth mentioning that they supposedly took Evelyn to their friend's farm at a location which has never been publicly disclosed, so for all we know, it could have been relatively close to La Crosse. But let's talk more about Jack Gaultier. I mentioned earlier that the Mattoon Journal-Gazette article said his name was Gaultier with a P, but I think that's a mistake. I think I should send a special shout-out to Anthony from the website crimeblogger1983.blogspot.com, who wrote an extensive article about this case and was able to dig up a couple of old newspaper articles about Jack Gaultier, where his name is spelled with a T, and since they mention him being from Lafarge, I'm pretty sure this is the same person referred to in the recording. Anyway, it appears that on October 25th, 1951, Gaultier and another man named Marion Driscoll were fined $100 each, given suspended jail sentences of 11 to 12 months, and placed on 2 years probation for, quote-unquote, contributing to the delinquency of a girl under 16. There aren't many details about the incident, except that Gaultier and Driscoll took the girl to a tavern before they took her back to Gaultier's home and into an upstairs bedroom. They actually appealed their conviction all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but the request for a new trial was denied, and you can actually find the decision online under State vs. Driscoll, Wisconsin, 1953. Well, if Gaultier was the type of guy who liked to prey on teenage girls, who's to say he wasn't capable of abducting a 15-year-old like Evelyn Hartley? In online discussions about this case, I've also seen a few people theorize that perhaps Marion Driscoll was the mutual friend who owned the farm where Evelyn was murdered. You can also find an article with Jack Gaultier's obituary online, as he shot himself at the age of 39 on Christmas Day in 1967. I find the timing to be interesting, since the recorded conversation in the tavern took place sometime in 1968, so perhaps Peterson and Barclay felt they could talk more freely about Evelyn's disappearance now that Gaultier was dead. You could easily infer that Gaultier's guilt over what he did to Evelyn compelled him to take his own life. While the police were going to check into this story, it doesn't look like they found any evidence to support it, and I have no idea if they had any real plans to exhume the bodies of the suspects in order to do DNA testing against the evidence they had. If the denim jacket and tennis shoes can still not be found after all these years, then it will be much more difficult to conclusively link anyone to the crime, especially since all the alleged perpetrators are currently deceased. And if Evelyn's body was actually buried in a Mississippi River floodplain and washed away, then it will probably be impossible to recover any remains after all this time. I don't know. There are far too many unanswered questions for me to conclusively believe that Jack Gaultier and his two accomplices were the perpetrators. Since Lafarge was an hour away from La Crosse, it's still unclear how Gaultier would have known that Evelyn was babysitting at the Rasmussen home that night. All that being said, if you look hard enough online, you will find a couple of comments from people who claim to have a personal connection to La Crosse, and they share uncorroborated rumors that Evelyn met Gaultier because students would sneak away to Lafarge to drink and party, and this is how he might have learned about Evelyn's babysitting gig. Of course, everything I've read about Evelyn makes her sound like a model teenager who wouldn't sneak away to another town an hour away to party, but perhaps she had a wild side her family didn't know about. So I can't speak to the veracity of these rumors that she personally knew Gaultier. Even so, if Gaultier and his accomplices took Evelyn all the way to Lafarge to murder her and bury her body, why would they return to an area only a couple of miles outside La Crosse to dispose of her bloody undergarments, along with the bloody tennis shoes and denim jacket? why not bury the evidence with Evelyn, or dispose of it in an area closer to Lafarge, where there isn't a large-scale search operation going on? Remember, the undergarments were discovered on October 27th, but the area had been previously searched the day before, and the undergarments were not there, so this would imply that Galther, or one of his accomplices, would have to make a special trip to La Crosse a few days after the crime to dump them there. Granted, this may have been a deliberate attempt at misdirection in order to keep the investigation away from Lafarge, but it's still fairly risky. With the way this crime was carried out, some people have always suspected that the perpetrator or perpetrators were locals who had knowledge of the area rather than out-of-towners like Galther and Peterson. If there was definitive proof that Evelyn had ties to Lafarge and had crossed paths with Galther before she went missing, then that would greatly increase my belief that the confession was legitimate and Galther murdered her, but otherwise, I can't say with absolute certainty that he was responsible. Overall, it would not surprise me at all if the killer was someone who never showed up on the radar and completely escaped detection. Whoever it was, chances are that they're long dead by now and will never face justice for this crime. It's unlikely this case will ever be solved, but it will always remain one of the most frightening missing persons cases ever. You'll always hear people share stories about how they lived in a peaceful community where you didn't even have to lock your doors, but then an horrific event like this took place, which changed everything. Like I mentioned in the intro, it's a situation right out of a horror movie, except that it involved a real-life monster rather than a supernatural one. Anyway, if someone still came forward with a tape-recorded confession after several decades, then I guess you can never completely write off the possibility of finding out what happened someday. So if by chance you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Evelyn Hartley, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts on this case, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We release some exclusive bonus episodes for our donors in tiers 2 and 3, and this month, we've got a special Halloween-themed bonus episode with supernatural overtones coming out very soon. I'm going to be covering the Teresita Bossa case, a real-life story about a murder victim whose ghost allegedly returned from the dead to name her killer. If only that sort of thing would happen more often. Anyway, to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up to support us on Patreon, and they are Eamon R., Aaron D., Lisa L., Daniel G., and Nikki C. And throughout this month, I've been giving shout-outs to our listeners who have continued to support us since we originally launched on Patreon 6 months ago, and I have been doing so in increments of 20. So this week, I'd like to express my thanks to Kat, Regina R., Jen F., Alyssa H., Laurel E. W., Nika P., Charlie W., Stephanie S., Jessica Y., Carolyn M., Carol C., Sandy G., Brett, Clinton R., Boots Callahan, Jules C., Emma M., Fiona C., Bradley B., and the We Just Nerd Here podcast. Thanks so much to everyone for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode, including the spooky Halloween version of the Trail Went Cold theme we've been playing this month. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another Halloween-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold.